Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and we're reading the first chapter called The Advent of Lord Krishna, the introduction. And yesterday we read about Mathura and the holy places, and today we're going to read what's going on there. So we're on text 29, and I'll read that one, and then we'll get up to 31 and 32. Text 29. Tasham tu karachich chaurir vasudeva krito dvaha devakya suryaya sardham prayane ratam aruhat. Translation. Some time ago, Vasudev, who belonged to the demigod family, or to the Surya dynasty, married Devaki. After the marriage, he mounted his chariot to return home with his newly married wife. Text 30. Ugrasena sutakamsaha swashupriya chikirshaya rasmin hayanam jagraha rautmairata shatarvitaha. Translation. Kamsa, the son of Ugrasena, in order to please his sister Devaki on the occasion of her marriage, took charge of the reins of the horses and became the chariot driver. He was surrounded by hundreds of golden chariots. Text 31-32, please repeat. Chatushatam paribharham gajanam hemamalinam ashvanam ayutam sardham Vatanam cha trisatshatam Dashinam sukamarinam Dveshate samalankrite Duhitre devakat pradhad Yani duhitra vatsalaha. Somebody chant. Vaishnavis? Thank you. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. Well, I guess we could do the transliteration. Shatam 400. Paribraham. Dowry. Gajanam. Of elephants. Hemamalinam. Decorated with garlands of gold. Ashvanam. Of horses. Ayutam. 10,000. Sardham. Along with. Ratanam. Of chariots. Cha. And. Trishatam. 3 times 600. 1,800. Dasinam. Of maidservants. Sukarinam. Sukamarinam. Very young and beautiful unmarried girls. Dwe, 2. Shate, 100. Samalankrite, fully decorated with ornaments. Duhitre, unto his daughter. Devakaha, King Devaka. Pradat, gave as a gift. Yani, while going away. Duhitra Vatsalaha, who was very fond of his daughter Devaki. Devaki's father, King Devaka, was very much affectionate to his daughter. Therefore, while she and her husband were leaving home, he gave her a dowry of 400 elephants nicely decorated with golden garlands. He also gave 10,000 horses, 1,800 chariots, and 200 very beautiful young maidservants, fully decorated with ornaments. Purport. The system of giving a dowry to one's daughter has existed in Vedic civilization for a very long time. Even today, following the same system, a father who has money will give his daughter an opulent dowry. A daughter would never inherit the property of her daughter, and therefore, an affectionate father, during the marriage of his daughter, would give her as much as possible. A dowry, therefore, is never illegal according to the Vedic system. Here, of course, the gift offered as a dowry by King Devaka to Devaki was not ordinary. Because Devaka was a king, he gave a dowry quite suitable to his royal position. Even an ordinary man, especially a higher class Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, is supposed to give his daughter a liberal dowry. Immediately after the marriage, the daughter goes to her husband's house, and it is a custom for the brother of the bride to accompany his sister and brother-in-law to exhibit affection for her. This system was followed by Kamsa. These are all old customs in the society of Varnashram Dharma, which is now wrongly designated as Hindu. These long-standing customs are nicely described here. So you young girls can eat your heart out. Such a nice dowry these people, Devaki got. You never see anything like it here in the States, that's for sure. But in general, Prabhupada was always happy to read all about these Vedic customs. In general, he upholded them as very traditional and very dear to the Vedic system of Varnashram. But at some times he would make a distinguish, as he did here, that he actually took the Vaishnav culture and separated it from being lumped in with the Hindu culture, especially when in regards to, let's say, giving pinda and demigod worship, things like that. Prabhupada didn't like to be known as a Hindu in regards to doing these type things, because he understood that the Vedic culture really was meant to enhance the devotion to the Supreme Lord, and the Supreme Lord's instructions were foremost in Prabhupada's teachings. And he was very, very careful in bringing the Vedic culture to the West. He was very thoughtful in how he presented Krishna consciousness so that we wouldn't reject the Vaishnava and Vedic culture. He wanted us to accept the basic teachings, and therefore some of the quote customs he didn't bring along, or else he sometimes even modified them a little bit. He was actually proud when we finally asked him, are there, you know, a few traditional things we can do, and, you know, like shaving the head and things like that. And he was really happy to actually instigate some of these customs. And many times in the lectures, especially in India, he would, well, he called us the dancing white elephants, but he was kind of proud of us that we had taken to this culture. We were dressed like Vaishnavs and adorned with tilak and everything. He was very happy that we had taken to it. And many of the basic things that he established here we can recognize, although they were very foreign. He established them just like fire yajnas. I mean, you don't go into your normal church and see someone building a fire and throwing things in and things like that. So he was very brave, and he felt that this was a very important part of the Vedic culture, so he established that. He also established a very elaborate deity worship, which was also a very meaningful move on his part. He very much insisted that we keep this a very high standard, and he was very very proud and also, again, very happy when Los Angeles reached some very high standard, and he would brag about that, that yes, in Los Angeles we have, you know, they have adopted so many wonderful elaborate arrangements for the pleasure of the Lord. And then, of course, the basic standards that go along with our sadhana, Prabhupada never compromised on those. The four regular principles, he was afraid that, you know, he would be given his walking papers if he, you know, said to the Western culture that, you know, no illicit sex, no intoxication, that they would say, okay, here's your papers, go home. But Prabhupada didn't compromise on those matters. But he was very willing to adjust for preaching purposes. Like when I went to Los Angeles, they had at that time the sanctuary, which was had all the stained glass windows and a podium. And we actually had lectures in there. Sunday feast lectures were given in there. And people were allowed, they could bring their shoes in there, things like that. So Prabhupada was not a fanatic. He was more fanatic about spreading Krishna consciousness than anything. And he would adjust. And it was kind of shocking to some of the devotees that he said, you know, don't take out the seats, let people come in with their shoes on. We want to make this a comfortable culture to adopt, and mainly so that they can hear the philosophy. That's the most important thing. So he was very willing to bend the rules. And of course he opened up the doors to the women to be able to become disciples, to engage in all kinds of service that even in India now still women are not allowed to do as far as deity worship, direct deity worship. So Prabhupada was very, very kind in that regard. He was also, in as far as marriage ceremony, when you think about the first marriage ceremony, he was kind of called to necessity out of that. He could see that the men and women were hanging out together and someone will come in the movement, not married. So therefore, he initiated the marriage ceremony. In the beginning, though, it was very simple. That was mostly time and circumstance. At that time, ISKCON didn't have much money, and most of our parents were non-devotees. I know for myself, my parents didn't come to my wedding. Some far-off, you know, friend of a neighbor or something happened to be in Dallas and came to the wedding, but my parents just were not into it. And they let me know about that by not coming to my wedding. And so it wasn't your normal big whoop-de-doo Vedic wedding that you hear about and you still see today. Did anyone's parents come to their wedding? No, a couple. Not too many, though. Not very many. So it was in different circumstances. But in the Vedic culture, this marriage ceremony was extremely important. And Prabhupada could see that it would become a very important part of our movement of the Hare Krishna culture, that everyone would become married, and that so therefore he initiated it, and he did quite a few marriages until, although sannyasis aren't supposed to do that, and then finally he faded out on the program. But in those first marriages, although he didn't, you know, have the elaborate garments and the ornate jewelry and all the, you know, whole week-long festival, but he emphasized the chastity, emphasized faithfulness, and he begged them no divorce, more or less demanded that. And then he really emphasized nice prasadam after the feast. Always at all the engagements, all the ceremonies, make sure there's very nice prasadam. And that has become one of the highlights and customs of the, and well-known of the Hare Krishna culture, of very nice prasadam always being distributed. So it's a matter of time and circumstance. We were definitely ready for nice prasadam. But here we can see that the Vedic culture, they went all out. Of course, he was a king. He had thousands of chariots. He had gold. He had wealth. And he, out of affection, gave these to his daughter. The Vedic culture is known for being a very close family-knit unit, and a lot of affection within that unit. And a little bit different than in the West. I'm sure Prabhupada was quite surprised to see all the, you know, the hippies being separated, leaving, and not agreeing and not being respectful, and all those good things that the West are known for. But it was an expression of the affection. Here also is describing how the sun went along all the way to the door of the new bride's home. Out of, you know, feeling that, oh, I'm going to be separated now from my daughter, from my sister. So this was also a tradition, a custom that was going on here with Devaki and her brother. So this affection actually brought about many, many customs in the Vedic culture that seems very strange. Like even the sati rite, it was a voluntary move. They had such affection for their husband that they felt like they couldn't, you know, go on without him, so they would volunteer to fall into that fire. Of course, that was outlawed. And then there was other, especially in the marriage department, like the swayambara, the husband-to-be would exhibit great strength and courage and show that he was going to protect his wife, he would fight for them. I was there in Los Angeles when Prabhupada described and how they would take the blood of the opponent and put it in, you know, when they'd fight for him, they put it in the pot, and Prabhupada said, "All right, so are you ready to do that?" And everyone kind of laughed. So this was all part of the Vedic custom. Even the arranged marriages were respected because it was out of love. They actually understood that the parents really had so much, you know, concern about the daughter's welfare that they would, you know, go to a great extent and really take time to find the proper husband, do astrological calculations, and really, you know, find the perfect match. And so it was respected, and it was accepted. But now that culture is being overridden by the the qualities of wanting to be independent and week-long ceremony, very exhausting. You could tell the people, I think it was like 12 o'clock in the morning, the people were just getting up because they'd been up till 3 o'clock putting turmeric all over the girls. I don't know, all kinds of things like that. So these were all very important. Although sometimes they get a little bit show-offish, or, you know, trying to show their how much money they have. I know Lakshmani went to a rich devotee's marriage in Bombay recently, and she said that people were flown in, at the parents' expense, and the minute they got there, they went in the room, and there was new sets of clothes, at least two new sets of clothes for the different. Occasions that were going to happen. There was a big polo match where everyone was invited to, and it was quite an affair. A little bit show-offish, but at least it was, you know, for the devotees' pleasures and for to welcome in the devotees and spiritual life into their in the new family's life. So this was very important. It secured a peaceful society, knowing that, you know, okay, a marriage, that means one-time marriage, we'll make it a big thing, and it'll ensure that. So it became a very spiritual event, and vows were taken in front of the deities. I don't even know if we do that anymore. It's usually out there now, I guess because of smoke or something, but a little bit of a shame. But so here we can see 1,800 chariots, 10,000 horses, golden garlands, quite a whoop-de-doo celebration. And here, what do? We tie a bunch of aluminum cams on the back of a car, and they go off and clank, 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 right? And that's the big thing, and they throw some rice or something. And in some other cultures, like in Africa, they spit on the lady, and then some part of the ceremony is you go to the in-laws, and they yell at you and scream at the lady, and all kinds of strange things are there. Anyway, we get some aluminum cans. Here they have golden chariots and things like that, a little bit different standard. There's a very nice discussion and conversation, and Prabhupada is talking about the dowry, how much was given in charity and things like that, and is mentioning how many horses and how they were all decorated. And Prabhupada said, so to a disciple, he said, so what would you do if someone gave you, you know, 100 horses or something like that? And the devotee goes, there's no way, you know, what would we, couldn't even take care of them. He said, even the zoo wouldn't know what to do with that many, you know. So it's a little bit different system here. I have this jewelry book of the Maharaja's jewelry, which is quite ornate. And it describes in there how the British, when they came to India and they saw a procession, it actually had a photo of this procession, and elephants, hundreds of elephants. And this was like not that long ago, you know? I mean, really not that long ago. It was when the British were there, for the 1800s, something like that. And the British, like, dropped their jaws when they saw that all the elephants had golden, you know, tapestries and things like that. So ceremonies were very much ornamented. Prabhupada said that actually in the marriage ceremony, that the dowry was, like it's described here, it wasn't given in estates, things like that, but it was given in mostly ornaments, jewelry, that the woman could wear, and it would be great wealth, worth something, real jewelry, not plastic jewelry, not glass jewelry, but the real stuff. And that way, a woman, when they're nicely decorated, they're very satisfied, and they'll become very faithful to their husbands. So this was the point. And he also said that they would be given hundreds and hundreds of saris. And he said not just normal saris, but Banaras saris with gold. And if you ever picked up or paid for Banaras saris or deities, they weigh a lot and they cost a lot. I remember we'd spend a good $400 on one sari in India. So this would be how it would work in as far as a dowry, that the wife would be satisfied and we would remain faithful for life. And so Prabhupada said that now women, they don't wear much jewelry in India. They don't give a lot of jewelry, not much ornamentation. Now they wear t-shirts and blue jeans like everybody else, right? You don't see them bedecked, which is a little unfortunate. Because in the Veda culture, if you didn't give this dowry, it was an insult to the lady. And you didn't want to start off relationships with your in-laws like that. You can read about Krishna Balaram. When Subhadra got married to Arjuna, they gave gems that looked, there was so much that was like waves to the Pandavas, just waves of gems, and what less all the different other things that were given. So this was also that when the queens were given to Krishna, as you know, like Jambavan, Jambavati, and Nagnajit gave his daughter, and who else? How else? All the queens came. Jambavan, Satrajit gave. They also gave thousands of maidservants along with their daughter to Krishna. But now the system of dowry is gone through some changes. There are still such things going on in different parts of the world, and in past days it was there. Some of the purposes were for protection of the daughter. It was some of the tradition was that you would give a dowry, and if you found that later that we mistreated, you would get it back. So this would be like a protection. You knew that if they messed around, that they would have to give back the money or whatever it was. And also it's traditional that the dowry was like a financial boost, especially if they were a young couple. You would help them out, you know, get their feet on the ground, and so they could start off a nice life. And then also, very traditionally, it would be a reciprocation with the other family. It would tie the different families together, and this would, which would increase that friendship. In Europe, a long time ago, the Greeks and Romans and things like that, they had a bride price to kind of make the lady more popular, I guess, it's more attractive. And then it got misused. They started to jack up the price, and they would increase their wealth and their power within their families and their big unit and within the empires. And so in the 19th and 20th century, it was outlawed in England. Dowries were not allowed because they were misused. In China today, a dowry is mainly for a show of social status. They save up and show how much they can give. In the United States, we have a different kind of a system now. It's the hope chest. Many girls have these, or in England it's called the lower bureau, or it's called the bottom drawer, and where you start giving things to the bride, all the things that she really wants. You start putting it in there, different members of the family and everything would. It would grow and grow, and then you'd have everything for your house and everything you wanted. And this would be, your hopes would be fulfilled by the hope chest. And it wasn't just things. Sometimes it would be blessings or poems and things that written. Now in ISKCON we have kind of a tradition that we've, at least in this community, is that you write blessings to the girl and you put it in there, or you give some advice, some little counseling from your thing, and you give it to the girl and hope that they'll have a keepsake and refer to it. So some of the traditions have changed. Now in India, in 1961, dowry was made illegal, although it has been pretty much ignored, because I couldn't understand why it was saying illegal. You know, I always thought dowry was just a dowry, no big deal, you know. But actually, it was made illegal, but mostly it's been ignored. They do have like a little top on it. I think the government has said that you can't give more than 7,000 rupees, which is a couple hundred dollars. So they capped it off because it was getting, with the increase of the middle age, the middle section class of society, that there has begun a demand for a dowry. Like ridiculous demand and a heavy demand, so much so that there are now institutions for all abused wives and the like, and even there has been a huge amount of murders and killing because people have not met what they've demanded for the money. It's a big crime in India, very big. I didn't realize it. It's just like shocking to hear that. So much so that the mother-in-laws get into it too, and to the point of killing daughter-in-laws and things like that. It's a very serious problem in India right now. So this has been made illegal. And so you can see that a long time ago, you know, these different cultures were there. They've been moderated. They've been lost, they've been shifted. And so now we can look into the Hare Krishna culture and maybe try to see even within our, you know, culture what has been kind of shifted and changed and what our outlook might be, even in regards to marriage. The arranged marriages, it was tried in the beginning. It was a disaster in pretty much all regards. And so it's been kind of nixed from the culture. The dream of Prabhupada of no divorce, ditto, nixed. We see it's happening all the time. Lamentable, for sure. And now even, not having illicit connections before marriage within the Hare Krishna culture, pretty much disregarded. Unfortunately, very lamentable. Kind of ironic since, we see the culture change, and just up in New York, if you look at the news, big celebration, right? Big shift of culture. Now you can have gay marriages. It's totally legal, right? How ironic, that you can see, shifting of the consciousness is, pretty sad. Now it's stamped and approved. Yes, gay marriages are perfectly all right. I'm wondering, when you have to fill in forms, they have Mrs., Miss, now, what, I don't know where that, it's going to have to be a new little bubble to, I don't know, Mrs., Miss, I don't know, anyway, whatever it is. Anyway, so we should see that that we should kind of analyze our customs in the Hare Krishna culture in regards to, let's say, codes of dress, even eating, what's being offered and eaten by devotees, standard of etiquettes, education, as far as the original Vedic culture or the original things that Prabhupada wanted for ISKCON. What has happened? And what's it going to look like in another 35 years, 40 years? Are we going to recognize the Hare Krishna movement? Or is it going to be merged into the other culture? Or are we going to change this culture? And maybe everyone will be Hare Krishnas. And maybe the judges will have tilak on. And will the changes be good? Will they be bad? And will some of the principles that Prabhupada did not compromise, or is it going to get so such that they're compromised? So we can see that there have been radical changes within the outer society. So will the Hare Krishna culture ride with the flow, or will it, what will happen? So Prabhupada said that a lot of the acceptance of the Veda culture was because they had faith in the Vedas. They had faith in the instructions of the spiritual masters. They had faith in the scriptures. So we should be very careful to individually and collectively keep that faith strong in Srila Prabhupada's instructions and in the scriptures. So that should be our endeavor. And hopefully some of these customs will still be there, and we will change the world. So maybe these topics have some thought behind them, or maybe have some discussion. Yes, Trivikram Prabhu?
So there's a fundamental point Srila Prabhupada made here with this dowry system. A girl gets dowry because she's not entitled to inherit the father's property later on. That would go to the son, you see? So that is why sometimes the emphasis is on the dowry, because you're going to get,
you still want to give him something, right?
That's all you're going to get now, really, nothing else. Right. I can remember when my father gave me his property, my sisters, they were trying
envious?
To... Yeah. But because I'm a devotee and, I know they're going to use it for sense gratification, I say, you guys got your share already. See? So, anyhow...
It's actually interesting. Lord Nityananda, when his daughter got married to Madhvacharya, a nice buddy, he gave a whole province.
Yeah. There was another word hinted in there, Hema, Malinim, or something like that. And you were talking about changes in India, really. One of the biggest changes is due to the movies, the film industry.
Yeah,
there was
Bollywood.
one movie star called Hema Malini, and she made a revolution in Indian movies. Really, she was actually so beautiful that you wouldn't believe. Even stars now can't even be compared with her. But that has really tremendously changed Indian culture also, the movie industry.
Yeah, the movie industry.
Big time.
Yeah, how unfortunate. Yes, Lookum.
Do you still have a standard India, like in Bollywood, where like they don't have like R-rated or PG-rated movies? Or is, 'cause like whenever I've seen, I don't see a lot, but the Indian movies are always like Bollywood. Has that changed?
I think it's stretched a little farther towards the X-rated, as far as, I mean, you never
never
used to see anybody embrace, even in the old movies, you know.
Yeah, but now do they
now? I don't know. I don't watch them. Anybody know? Everyone's seen. Sometimes I glance at the covers of the DVDs when I go buy Indian goods. They seem like they're getting a little risque to me. Pretty risque, huh? Oh, yeah. Okay, we're getting a nod over there, yes. Dharmaraj Prabhu?
Actually, when my son came back from Gurukul, he mentioned one thing. He said that in India they're more wild and vulgar than out here in America in terms of their street activities.
I'm not surprised.
Anyway, you were describing of this level of affection that these family members have in Vedic culture. So I'm not sure if I'm confusing that with attachment, because in Vedic times the culture was stronger than everyone has a sense of duty and spiritual understanding of mainly a life of renunciation. So when we hear of all these different elaborate arrangements and so much affection that they have for each other, and I'm just wondering how, with that level of affection, how that level of renunciation is still there, if you can explain.
Well, there was the Varnashram system was the four different divisions of your life, and that's why it was a big deal to become a Varnaprast. You'd have to, that's why the woman would even go with them, and sometimes they'd bring, you know, food out to the things. That affection was very strong. So to do that renunciation and then to go all the way to sannyas, it was a big thing, because that attachment was so strong. But that was the system. But they, because of the Gurukul system, because of all these different things, intellectually and sociably, it was able to happen. The affection would be able to change. Like to send your children away at 5, that would, you know, the boy to school, that would be very difficult. But they would do it, you know, because it was just part of the system that would make everybody stronger. It seemed like the whole system would be to strengthen the affection and the ability to detach. It's a pretty amazing combination, if you ask me. But it was the arrangement. It had to be a full-time arrangement. It had to work on all sides. So that's why the Varnashram system, everything had to kind of be in order.
Actually, when I first joined Krishna consciousness, one of the very first questions I asked the devotees was in the same regard, that we thought coming to Krishna consciousness, well, we're talking about renunciation. So, but when I saw the devotees who were married, they have children, and in to my knowledge, like they were more attached to their children than the karmis were. So I ask about that. So one explanation was that, of course, yes, that level of attachment is there not because we're in Krishna consciousness. On the other hand, because they're devotees, then you naturally become more attached to them. So I'm not sure if you have any other explanation.
Maybe someone else does. I mean, this is your responsibility. Prabhupada told us to take it very seriously. He says, don't become a father or a guru or anything like that unless you can deliver them. So unless you keep them roped in with affection, they're going to be out there, that's for sure. Yes?
I think they still in ISKCON have arranged marriages. They have this one Mataji, Krishnanandini. I think she does arranges for marriage.
Well, glorious to the success. Huh? I hope they have success. Yes.
In the purport or the translation, I can't remember which, when they're describing the distribution, giving away of the elephants and the chariots and the horses and the golden garlands and then the 400 maidservants. Someone reading that might think, how can you give away a person? It sounds like slavery. So how would you explain that to someone?
I have no explanation. Sorry. I could never understand it. And when I think about it, it seems pretty bizarre that there would... Okay, here. I'm sure it was a certain class of society.
Are we talking about the bride or are we talking about the maidservants?
The maidservants.
The maidservants, okay. The maidservants go along with the bride to assist her and to be her companions. They're her friends. And they basically live with the husband and the wife.
So what class do they come from?
Well, you're talking about kshatriyas primarily. They're like ladies in waiting to a queen, and then they get married off themselves, bit by bit.
So it's a temporary situation.
Yeah, it's all done out of desire.
So parents would I'm just practically speaking, a parent would offer their daughter to do that service.
We're talking
it,
about
proud.
Two, yeah, we're talking. Thing? First of all, you have to understand we're talking about two different classes. One, the kshatriyas are the rulers. Mm-hmm. The brahmins are the scholars. The kshatriyas are the rulers. There's only a few kshatriyas in the whole of society. I can't remember the numbers, but it's like one brahmin for every 1,000. I've heard that, and three kshatriyas for every 1,000. It's like it becomes. There's several different visions of how many per 100 or so, but these people are taking shelter of the kshatriyas, just like somebody gets a job with the government. Essentially, and so they go into those jobs. There weren't salaries, but there was room and board, and there was food. I mean, there was clothing, and so they were taken care of. The whole business of the Vedic culture is that the leaders take care of the constituents or the subjects, and so that's not since that stopped being the case in since the Middle Ages. That stopped being the case when people declared their independence from that system. Then many things have degraded. Ideally, a leader doesn't exploit his followers. Ideally, a patron doesn't exploit the peasants. But today we see that that's the case. That people are short-term allegiances with companies and organizations and so forth, and so they're out for themselves, and the company's out to exploit to the max, get the most out of the worker. So that you're looking at a whole, if you try to compare this civilization with that civilization, you're looking at a whole different motivation and modus operandi and basic desires for people. Now, you can't really say this is slavery. Slavery today is, you buy a house and you work for the bank for the rest of 30 years. That's the kind of slavery we have today. And if you don't pay, they take your house away. So, like that.
Nice. Thank you. Okay. Glory to Prabhupada.